Welcome to MetaStrategy's Forum on World-Class IT. I'm Peter High, and I'm pleased to welcome Jim Whitehurst to the broadcast. Jim is the Chief Executive Officer and President of Red Hat Incorporated, the world's first billion-dollar open-source software company. Prior to his time at Red Hat, Jim served as the Chief Operating Officer of Delta Airlines, and he previously held the role of Senior Vice President and Chief Network and Planning Officer at Delta. Prior to his tenure at Delta, Jim was Partner and Managing Director of Boston Consulting Group, and he held various leadership roles in their Chicago, Hong Kong, Shanghai, and Atlanta offices. Jim's been a director at Red Hat since January of 2008, and he's been a director of Digital Globe Incorporated since August of 2009. Jim holds a bachelor's degree in computer science and economics from Rice University. He also attended Erlangen-Nuremberg University in Erlangen, Germany, and holds a general course degree from the London School of Economics and an MBA from the Harvard Business School. I recently caught up with Jim in his office in Raleigh, North Carolina, and our conversation covered World-Class IT Principle 1, People, as Jim discussed the evolving role of the CIO and his suggestions for adjusting the career paths of talented IT employees. Principle 4, IT and Business Partnerships, as Jim discussed how open source enables innovation and leads to better collaboration between colleagues and with customers. Principle 5, External Partnerships, as Jim discussed how Red Hat creatively leverages partnerships with other leading-edge companies to develop new innovations, as well as a variety of other topics. The Forum on World-Class IT is brought to you by Red Hat, the world's leading open source solutions provider. Learn more at redhat.com. Welcome to the Forum on World-Class IT.
Hey, it's great to be here. Thank you.
Jim, first and foremost, I wanted to congratulate you on being the first billion-dollar open-source organization. And I thought we'd begin with the whole notion of open source. I think it's a topic that a lot of people in technology know something about, but there are probably a fair number of technologists who kind of scratch the surface and might think of it as sort of a cheap operating system, and perhaps that's the extent of it. And maybe as somebody who's so deeply involved in that space, maybe you can offer us some definitions from your perspective.
Sure. Well, let me start off with the very basics on open source and then kind of talk about where it is and isn't most effective. So open source very easily means that the source code is distributed along with the binary code that the computer runs. And so that's a relatively simple definition. But the interesting component is what happens when that human readable code is made available downstream to the users. And that is users start contributing. So they see a bug, they'll post bug fixes. Large users will see whole new things that they want and start contributing those things back. So just a couple examples. The security regime that's in Red Hat Enterprise Linux and in all Linux was written by the NSA for their security needs and contributed back. Intel, when they come out with a new chip, they can spend years in advance enabling those chips in the operating system in Linux and obviously contribute that in. So the real power is not necessarily that the code's open, it's that various constituents, whether it's hardware providers or regular users, can contribute what they need back into the code and overall make the code better.
So it facilitates collaboration to a greater extent, obviously, and many people say that that's the essence of innovation. So I know that a lot of what you've been speaking about is Red Hat's enablement of innovation through all the things that you do. Can you talk a little more about that connection point?
Sure. And that's exactly what we see is there are some fundamental research type things that need to be done upstream by suppliers. But so much of the innovation we're now seeing in information technology comes out of users first. So take almost any new innovation, big data, which is a hot topic right now. I can't think of a single proprietary innovation that's happened in big data, whether it's Hadoop, Cassandra, all the NoSQL databases. All of those things have happened in open source. And it's not because of Red Hat or other open source companies. It's because the mega IT users now are running into problems that vendors hadn't even dreamed of. And when I say users, I mean Google and Amazon and Facebook and Yahoo. And so these companies see problems for their businesses, and they have the financial wherewithal to hire developers to fix them. And they do it in open source and contribute that code back because they don't see those things as strategic to their business. It's basic infrastructure. And then for companies like Red Hat, and over time, I'll argue Oracle, IBM, and others are going to have to figure out business models to say, how do we take all of this innovation and make it consumable for our enterprise customers? And that's really why Red Hat exists, right? So certainly a lot of people think of open source as, oh, that's that free stuff. It's not quite as good, but it's free and isn't that great. And yes, there's a lot of use of open source that's truly free, as in no cost at all. But if you look at Red Hat's customer base, it's just the opposite. It's the major stock exchanges. It's the banks. It's the telcos running mission critical applications. So the majority of the world's stock exchanges and the majority of the world's equity trades happen every day on Red Hat Linux. You know, nuclear submarines, your telco billing systems all run on Red Hat Linux. And these companies obviously aren't buying this to be low cost, right? The New York Stock Exchange isn't using Red Hat because it's cheaper. It's because it's faster and more secure. And the reason Red Hat exists is the very power of the open source model as a development model makes it impossible to use in enterprise production. What I mean by that is the power of open source is thousands of people contributing code. And that's great for getting rid of bugs or adding new features and functionality, but it's a disaster running it in an enterprise in a production environment. And that's what Red Hat does. Every 2 years, we freeze the spec across all of our products, whether that's Linux or our myriad middleware products or virtualization. We freeze the spec and say, okay, we're going to support this for the next 10 years. And there's huge costs in that. Our R&D as a percentage of revenue is higher than most other software companies, believe it or not. And that's partially because our price points are lower because it's open source, but it's because our real cost is committing to supporting those products for 10 years. So if you think about the New York Stock Exchange, if they're using a three-year-old version of Red Hat Linux, Intel enables a new chip, they're doing that in the brand new kernel. We have to backport that into the old kernel. And so it's all of those things that we do to make open source capable of running the most mission critical, most highest performing, most secure systems in the world.
Makes sense. I'm curious how the philosophy of open source and all that you've just described, how that impacts management structure and processes at Red Hat. How do you bring that inside, so to speak? I think to some people, it might almost seem antithetical to the traditional management structures and hierarchies. How do you see it translating?
Oh, it's been fascinating. So I came from the airline business, right. And you can't get a more hierarchical structure of primarily ex-military people, where literally people would sometimes salute right, to Red Hat, which is just built on a whole different culture around open source. It is literally night and day in how we think about running the organization. And the parallels for leadership in Red Hat, or I would argue in high-performing communities, often parallel what Red Hat does in open source. So we often say we don't lead anything, right? Our mission statement says we are the catalyst in communities of ... And the word catalyst is talking about how we influence behavior. And as CEO, we have brilliant people who can go work anywhere, who are the leaders in their open source communities. I can't tell them what to do. Our head of engineering or our CTO can't tell them what to do. We influence, right? So we work to try to catalyze. So when I look at my job, it's much less about mandating what happens. I think about, first off, context. How do I build a culture where people feel comfortable saying what they want to say, where transparency is not only rewarded but required, where we focus on meritocracy. It's not a democracy. Somebody brand new, you can yell and scream all you want. People aren't going to listen until you've earned your stripes. And that worked to catalyze behavior by engaging, involving people in decision-making, really working to inspire a direction that we're trying to go, and then ultimately try to influence decisions that are made. It's a vastly different way to manage an organization. But I'll actually argue in many ways superior. So I was a consultant for a long time, and you know, consultants often do change management and consulting for the change management practices. And that's because generally executives make a decision that they then want to force and roll out through their organization. It takes a lot longer to do what we do, where I try to influence and work to get decisions to come up from the bottom up. So it takes us much longer to make a decision, but we never have to worry about change management. By the time we made a decision, everybody knows what we're doing, why they felt that they were engaged in the decision. Even if they don't like the output or the ultimate decision, they know that they had a voice in it, and therefore execution happens quickly. So it turns the model on its head. It's not quick decision-making, long implementation. It's long decision-making, flawless implementation. And I have to say, having lived in both worlds, this is a far superior way to operate.
Yeah, that makes sense. Can I ask just personally, what was that transition like going from, as you point out, in some ways, the definition of hierarchy in the airline industry to one that has a lot less of it? Was it quite a transition for you as a leader?
Oh my God, it was the strangest thing. I remember going home and talking to my wife. It's like, I think I have a bunch of people who are so insubordinate, I may have to fire the whole team. I mean, seriously, there'd be tons. I'd say, I think we ought to go do X. And I get kind of people nodding. This is my, you know, direct reports. And a few weeks later, I'll say, well, did we go do that? And I got back the, no, we kind of thought that was a stupid idea. That would never happen, right? Would never happen.
Right.
And so for a while I thought, well, literally, do I need to like fire these people? They're not listening to me. And then you find out over time that just works its way through the organization. Simple example, we have this mailing list called Memo List where we talk about real strategic issues associated with the company. And early on when I was here, it started to go off subject. So everybody in the company is subscribed to this and can communicate on it. And it started, people were saying things that were funny, that weren't really related to the business, or at times almost being rude and calling people stupid and things that just weren't necessarily appropriate. So of course I said, well, we just need to set some rules around this thing. And my team looks at me, it's like, you're crazy. If we set rules, people will stop participating. And of course I came back and said, well, we have to make some change, right? We can't just sit here and let this thing kind of go off in a direction that's not productive for the business. And they said, yeah, but this is easy. I says, well, what do you mean? They're like, well, let's just go find the 10 biggest posters, the people who do the most on there, and tell them this is the problem. This is supposed to be productive for you and for the whole company. Go fix it. So we went and just told the 10 people to do it. So it was this peer-to-peer management. So they came back and said, look, we want to create another forum called Friday List for people to post funny things because, you know, it's we're a fun-loving culture. You need a place to do that. Yeah. And for people who want to subscribe to that, that's optional and you can be involved in that. And then we, meaning these 10, say, we'll self-police when people start getting a little out of line and we'll tell them, hey, that's not appropriate. And it's a peer-to-peer management system that just worked perfectly. Within 3 weeks, everything's perfect. Again, we didn't mandate it, which would have shut the whole thing down. We got the people it was most important to. We catalyzed them to fix the problem. And that's really what this new kind of leadership style is about. And it took me a long time to get it. I think it's really hard until you get immersed in it to fully understand.
Great examples. Jim, a lot of your customers are CIOs, and you have some deep insights as to what that role entails, what it entails to be successful in the CIO role. And you've said that CIOs are often more strategic than they're given credit for. And where there are issues, oftentimes it's a degree or two removed from the CIO. And his or her success, needless to say, is going to be dependent upon the team that he or she is surrounding themselves with. Can you talk a bit about how you see that role evolving and the ways in which CIOs can bring about the appropriate level of productive strategic change that they should, given their roles in the organization?
Well, I think the good news is most CIOs now, people understand the importance of information in an information economy. So CIOs have a lot of opportunities to go, whether it's external conferences or reporting structures moving higher in the organization, to get a chance to really see a lot of the business, which is great. But generally, the career path up through to CIO is an IT career path. It's not people necessarily bouncing in and out as much. And the problem with that is just where we are generationally. Most of the CIO's direct reports came up through the ranks in the 1990s. And I was a consultant in the 90s, so I saw this too. It was the age of reengineering. Right, reengineering the corporation, implementing ERP systems. And if you remember all of it, it was process, process, process. How do I remove variants from systems? Right, it was almost factory IT. And all those are great skills, but those are almost the antithesis of the skills you need to help a marketing organization. You almost want to say, hey, we need to go back and inject a little more variance into our processes, right? So the problem that I think happens a lot is that next layer down that's interfacing with the line of business owners, where really the rubber hits the road in terms of building new functionality. I see gaps happen all the time where you get people saying, all right, how do I systematize and process something and think about how I do this that'll last for 5 or 10 years, where the marketing people are sitting there saying, I mean to throw this thing away in 4 months. You got to get this in production in 2 months. It might last another 2 months, and then we're throwing it away. And that's a whole different mindset. And building culturally as CIO, internal for IT, to build those skill sets for that next couple of layers of leadership who've come up in a whole different world and were successful because they were good at all called factory IT is probably the largest challenge I think CIOs have. It's not themselves having FaceTime with this CEO. It's much more how they build that kind of organizational change model within IT. So throughout their organization, those engagements are happening in a way that's productive for the business.
Do you see an advantage to CIOs or other members of the leadership team within IT spending time in other parts of the organization or having come from a different part of the organization or a different background?
I think the more that we can make that wall between IT and the business fluid with people moving in and out, the better off we'll be. Because that's when people actually, you know, if you can have somebody somehow step into a marketing role and then back later on and see kind of the different processes and the way people think, you almost feel like again, I hate to use the analogy, most people from IT kind of came out of the factory side. Mm-hmm. And if you could have more people in a traditional manufacturing environment from the factory, spend some time in marketing and vice versa, everybody would be better off. And it's a little bit the same with IT. So really thinking about those roles in the CIO, engaging with the heads of HR and how to build career paths that might span back and forth is going to become more and more critical as more and more of the capabilities that lead to competitive advantage become information-based going forward.
That makes sense. Absolutely. Can you talk to us a bit about the plans for the year ahead? Where do you see Red Hat going and the extent to which that's offering a broader context to how you see IT evolving more generally speaking? Can you share some insights?
Sure. You know, the interesting thing for Red Hat is we sit with one foot in two different worlds, right? I'll call it the world of 99.999, kind of the five nines of reliability, and the world of 99.9. And I think this is the challenge a lot of CIOs live every day, where I feel like many IT organizations, enterprise IT organizations, are being held accountable for five nines of reliability around security, uptime, et cetera, yet the expectations for the cost levels and the speed of functionality additions, they're being compared to Google and Amazon and Facebook, who run whole different systems. And, you know, the simple example, I know it sounds trite, but it's true. You know, how many times have you done a search on Google and the thing just never comes back? And so you hit refresh and then it pops up. That's fine if you're doing a web search. But if somebody just deposited their paycheck and that's the transaction that got lost, you're getting fired as the CIO if that happens, you know, as often as a search kind of gets bogged down. So the expectation level for a traditional enterprise IT is literally several orders of magnitude higher performance and more secure than a traditional Web 2.0 company. Yet CEOs look at their kids collaborating on Google Docs and wonder why they can't do that in their enterprise and why everything's so expensive. So Red Hat, we kind of play that world because the big Web 2.0 companies are large customers of ours. But the reason big enterprises pay us is we deliver those five nines of reliability. And so it's continuing to work to take those products that are really being further honed in Web 2.0 companies and really hardening them for the enterprise. So we're best known for enterprise Linux. You know, it's second only to Windows in terms of absolute size and footprint. Certainly, if you look at mission critical environments, it's the leading operating system. It's bigger than all the Unixes combined. But if we look at storage, which was really incubated in a bunch of Web 2.0 companies, we'll do for storage what we did to compute by commoditizing that. Middleware and platform as a service and all of these things that we've incubated really with Web 2.0 companies, bringing those to the enterprise are what we're doing. So a full stack to be able to say you want a private cloud, PaaS, all of those components, we built those and are now launching those into the enterprise at the service levels and security levels that an enterprise can and should expect.
The early part of your answer alluded to consumerization of IT and that there's so much innovation that's happening in consumer-based technologies that are influencing corporate-based technologies. And I wonder how you think about that. How do you engage your own people, or how do you think about engaging external parties or partners of various kinds in order to get a firmer handle as to where consumerization is leading and therefore drawing some of the insight from that?
Well, we have a lot of our developers, and really our rock star developers, we don't tell what to do. They get involved in communities. So a lot of these consumerization of IT, people often think about the end Apple type devices, but a lot of it is the functionality that a Yahoo or a Google is throwing up on their websites. And so underneath all of that is open source stacks of software. So it's getting our developers involved in those. And when we think they're mature enough, that's when we think about how we move those over to the enterprise. And it's an interesting model in that you can't centrally plan that. I can't sit there with my team at the beginning of the year and say, okay, here are the five things we think are really interesting. Let's go try to commercialize them. What we actually do is scatter a minority, but call it 50 of our key enterprise developers out there just to be watching the market, whether it's Web 2.0 company or some other enterprise or wherever new innovations are happening, and coming back and saying, wow, this is a real technology we think our enterprise customers want that's really starting to take off in this other area. And so we really let it happen organically.
That makes sense. And are there certain guideposts for them to look towards? I mean, do you think of sort of a central core area that you kind of have adjacencies to that you could build out to? Or is it a blue sky as these developers are going out there?
For us, it's generally we look for adjacencies around what we do today.
Yeah.
We're a for-profit firm, right?
Yeah, of course.
We look for areas where we think that we have skills that we can help catalyze those communities. And since we do infrastructure, you know, one last year, something called InfiniSpan, which is a distributed data caching don't want to get too technical, but it becomes a really big deal around performance as you think about these larger web footprints that companies can have. It kind of emerged on its own in a whole bunch of places, and we're like, okay, that's a technology that's close enough to our middleware portfolio, close enough to infrastructure. Our customers really seem to like it. Okay, we're going to commercialize that. We'll hire a few of the developers. We'll offer an enterprise product. And so that's kind of naturally how those things will often work. Or, you know, I remember JP Morgan had a messaging platform that they really were excited about. They developed on their own, and we worked to help them ultimately open source it and commercialize it. So it really happens organically, but we generally stay at the infrastructure level because that's kind of what we're good at and what we think we can help catalyze.
And given the nature of all that we've talked about for better collaboration, having people that are, whether inside the company or outside, providing unique and important insights as to where innovation is going to be happening, how does that impact the way in which you and the company think about external partnerships of various kinds? Is there an ecosystem that you think of and draw upon as you develop new ideas?
Well, the ones that we like the best are especially the leading Web 2.0 companies, whether they're customers or not. I just remember talking to the CTO at one of the very, very large, well-known social networking company.
Right.
I don't think you would care if I mentioned the name, but he's talking about functionality that they need in a product feature that they want to offer in 2 weeks that does not exist in their functionality today. And so he has developers pulling all-nighters, getting that technology into the code base so that they can launch whatever that new feature is. Contrast that with a traditional IT vendor R&D department with a 5-year timeline to figure out XYZ. It's just such a fast pace of innovation that we're seeing happening coming out of the Web 2.0 companies. And so making sure that we stay close to them, whether or not they're a customer or not, and seeing what technologies they're working on is key. And it ultimately accrues to our customers. So, you know, my easy example on that, Google's new cloud is built on our virtualization. So they're contributing features they need to be able to scale virtualization to levels unimaginable for anybody but Google. The good news when I go talk to enterprise customers and say, well, can it scale? It's like, well, yeah, it can scale today. And if it can run Google's cloud, it'll probably run what you want to do. And by the way, any roadblocks that come up going forward, they're fixing them. So really looking to find leading, bleeding edge, really, type of companies that are solving problems that the traditional enterprise won't run into for 4 or 5 years, and making sure we're engaging with them, whether they're paying us or not, is almost irrelevant. We want them using those technologies and contributing back what they need. Exactly. And so those are the companies we really work to make sure we stay close to and engage in. And they're great partnerships because, again, they want to leverage not only their contributions, but others' contributions as well, which is the whole power of the open source model.
Exactly. Well, Jim Whitehurst, it's been a great conversation. I really appreciate you taking this time on the Forum on World Class IT and sharing your insights.
Thank you. It's been great to be here.
The Forum on World Class IT is proud to have Red Hat, the world's leading provider of open source solutions, as a corporate sponsor. Red Hat was recently named by Forbes magazine as one of the world's most innovative companies, an honor Red Hat shares with its customers, partners, and developer communities. To learn more about how Red Hat technologies help to drive innovation and growth, visit www.redhat.com/innovation. You've just listened to a podcast in a series we call Meta Strategies Forum on World Class IT. If you like what you've heard, please consider reading my book, World Class IT, Why Businesses Succeed When IT Triumphs, published by Josie Bass, a division of Wiley Press, in December of 2009. Both the book and the Forum on World Class IT offer stories from a wide range of top IT leaders relating to Meta Strategies' 5 principles of world class IT. The 5 principles are as follows. Principle 1 is people, and it's really the foundational principle. Without the right people doing the right jobs at the right time, it'll be nearly impossible to achieve excellent performance. The second principle is infrastructure. We like to say that this is the principle that separates proactive organizations from reactive ones. If infrastructure is not reliably performing its tasks, the IT organization will become stuck in reactive mode, consistently fighting fires. If systems and hardware and networks and so on work reliably, then a larger portion of the organization can think about the future. The third principle is project and portfolio management. This is the engine through which new capabilities can be brought to bear on behalf of the company. It is important to ensure that projects are delivered on time, on budget, and on target, and that the portfolio collectively supports the objectives of the business. The fourth principle is IT and business partnerships. It's important that first and foremost, the different parts of IT, from business analysis to development and QA, through to support and all other aspects of IT, communicate effectively and efficiently. It's equally important then that IT develop a partnering relationship with the business that it is a part of. If the three prior principles are done well, then IT should earn a place at the strategy setting table, driving different parts of the business strategy. The fifth and last principle is external partnerships. Outsourcing is becoming a crucial weapon that organizations are employing, and managing these relationships to ensure that value is achieved is critical. In the fourth principle, the organization has learned and contributed to the discussion about what is strategic and what is not. Once that's clear, then it will be easier to determine which aspects of IT might be better managed by external partners or vendors. For more information on these five principles and the sub-principles that are associated with each, please visit our website at www.metastrategy.com, and please share your thoughts and comments by contacting us at feedback@metastrategy.com. Our editors are Chris Davis and Calhan Kuhl, and our theme music was written by David Arman. I'm Peter High. Thanks for listening.